associated with Iran.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Israel at the moment defines its security as continuing to enjoy absolute and total impunity, as the ability to shoot at and kill whoever Israel wants, wherever Israel wants, whenever Israel wants, for as long as it wants, without paying any kind of price. I think that the potential agreement between the United States and Iran would have spoiled that tremendously. I think Israel is attempting to operate as a disruptor throughout the Middle East. Any kind of longstanding, obliging agreement that would perhaps settle the very volatile political climate, the most threatening one for the security of Israel, as I now defined it, would have been an agreement between the United States and Iran.
And Ori, what about the impact of this Netanyahu decision on the popular protest movement against him within Israel? As a result of these attacks now, basically, the population is forced to shelter in place.
Well, I just read an interesting Facebook post this morning where this young man who was, I think, a senior operative in the protests said, all you people who think that this is simple, that we shouldn't go to war, or that we should destroy all of our enemies at once, you should realize that reality is complex. And I think I'm quoting directly when I say, he wrote, "This war is the essence of Zionism, or the purpose of Zionism. But on the other hand, we are against this vile government. For now, we have a war to win, so it's not time for sowing propaganda and dissent against the government." I think that's a very popular attitude, especially among the people who protested against Netanyahu. Israelis are known for rallying around the flag. I would say that Netanyahu's conviction that should he begin a war with Iran, his political support would skyrocket. I think that's proved to be quite wise on his part, certainly for the short term. Iran is the most broad consensus there is in Israeli politics. For at least a generation, Israelis have grown up with an official narrative saying that all Iran is interested in is the apocalyptic destruction of Israel, that Iran is religiously committed to it, that its leaders are preaching it every day in the mosques, and that ordinary Iranians, and here there's a bit of a schizophrenic approach to Iran, ordinary Iranians on the one hand are resisting their religious rulers, but on the other hand, this is what they hear all the time, so one can count on Iran to do everything it can to destroy Israel when the window presents itself. This means that anybody who goes to war against Iran, especially after 2 years of abject shame and failure in Gaza, the Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza was not a success as far as most Israelis are concerned. After 2 years of this abject failure, Israel was very thirsty for a quote-unquote win. The first night of Israel's war with Iran was spectacular tactically. And a lot of Israelis are now, I don't want to say jubilant, because as you say, not only are we sheltering in place, but the entire fabric of life of this country has been tremendously disturbed. Israelis are not jubilant, but Israelis, most of them, the great majority of them, are saying this is the most just war Israel has ever fought, and we should continue fighting it. Just as a last point, that phrase, the most just war Israel has ever fought, was exactly the same phrase used to justify Israel's actions in Gaza. The assassinations that Israel is carrying out in Iran right now are precisely the MO Israel used in Gaza. Israel is, in effect, trying to destroy Hamas in Tehran.
And what is your sense of how the Iranians have responded so far, and what might be a way to achieve some kind of ceasefire and truce here?
According to IDF assessments, more than 90% of the Iranian missiles were targeted at military sites. In Israel, military sites are very much a part of the civilian lay of the land, despite Israeli accusations against Hamas that this is a horrible crime. I think the Iranians so far have responded well within their means. They've not gone overboard. They've not staged some kind of suicide attack in response to Israel's strike. I think the Iranians are trying to pace themselves. I think they're saving a lot for potential escalation. But I get the sense that the Iranians are quite ready to sit down and talk. The political decision that needs to be made is one that needs to be made in Jerusalem. I don't know if Israel is capable at this stage of making such a decision. Netanyahu is very much high on his own supply. He feels invigorated. He feels he has re-won the support of the people. This should come from the outside. The talks, ceasefire, potential de-escalation, as the G7 leaders call it, this should be superimposed from the outside. I don't see the Israeli public, and certainly not Israel's leadership, making such an independent decision at this time.
Ori Goldberg, we want to thank you so much for being with us, an Israeli political analyst in Tel Aviv. We will link to your piece about the real reason you believe Israel attacked Iran. And I want to thank Negar Mutazevi, who is an Iranian-American journalist. Her podcast is the Iran Podcast. She's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. When we come back, we go to Minnesota, where the alleged assassin of former State House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband has been arraigned on federal and state charges. We'll speak with one of the people on the hit list of the assassin. We'll speak with Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about greed, trying to find a way to talk about greed.
Greed is a poison rising in the land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus seeking out
greed by Sweet Honey in the Rock in our old firehouse studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Minnesota, where federal and state officials have announced murder and stalking charges against Vance Belter, the suspect accused of assassinating Democratic State House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband in their home, as well as for shooting State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yvette. Joseph Thompson is acting U.S. Attorney for Minnesota.
Political assassinations are rare. They strike at the very core of our democracy. But the details of Belter's crime are even worse. They are truly chilling. It is no exaggeration to say that his crimes are the stuff of nightmares. Belter stalked his victims like prey. He went to their homes, held them out as a police officer, and shot them in cold blood.
Authorities say Belter first shot the Hoffmans multiple times, then went to two other lawmakers' homes. One wasn't home before he then killed the House Speaker Emerita and her husband. They also discovered a hit list that included Planned Parenthood centers and the names of many Democratic politicians, including Minnesota Senator Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar, and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. A vigil was held Monday in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, to honor the victims. After the shootings, many recommended the Minneapolis No Kings rally Saturday be canceled, since No Kings signs were found in the suspect's car. And people were concerned that since he was still on the loose on Saturday, he could attack the protest. But thousands gathered anyway on the state capitol steps, including one of the Democratic officials on the hit list, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison.
She was a powerful political leader and a good person because she understood some basic things about life in our society. She understood that everyone is entitled to due process. She understood that kids learn better on a full stomach, so she fought for universal school meals.
Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison joins us now for more. Attorney General, our deepest condolences to you, to Minnesota. So many across the political spectrum loved the state House Speaker Emerita, Melissa Hortman, and her husband. If you can talk about who she was and also the charges that have been brought against the alleged assassin.
Well, I met her before either one of us were in politics. Melissa Hortman was a legal aid lawyer. When I met her, she was representing a tenant African-American woman, mother of three, who had been the target of discrimination and abuse by her landlord. It was alleged that the landlord would say things like, hey, girls don't have to pay rent if they're nice. And this particular tenant was very lucky to have Melissa Hortman as her lawyer, who fought and won a very large judgment against this landlord. I actually represented that same client in another matter. And so Melissa and I got to know each other. I went to the state legislature. She went, and we got to be really good friends. And she was always on the right side of the issues, had a strong moral compass, but was always pragmatic and willing to reach across the aisle and try to come up with some solutions that work for everyone. And she rose to the level of speaker. I went on to the U.S. Congress, as you know, Amy, and I got to admit, I tried to convince her to run in the 3rd congressional district, but she said, no, I'm here in Minnesota. I'm going to stay here in Minnesota and serve the state of Minnesota. I don't have any aspirations for Washington. And she did a wonderful job. She helped lead on the issue of the child tax credit, universal school meals, driver's license for everybody, paid sick and family leave in the state of Minnesota, and also expansions in health care, prescription drug pricing. She just was dedicated to trying to make people's lives easier, and she was pretty effective at it. She also knew that sometimes she had to take the hard vote, and she did, because she knew she had to land that budget negotiation. But right up until we lost her, she was fiercely fighting for people, always polite, always kind. And by the way, she was really funny, and she had a smile that would light up any room. But she had a great sense of humor, was sort of a joker, and could lighten the mood with her sense of humor. I just am really going to miss her, and I know everybody will here. We loved her. She was the best.
Well, Attorney General, could you talk to us about this climate of political violence, not only in your state, but that has been spreading the past few years across the country, and what can be done to change that?
Well, Juan, you and I and Amy all will remember what happened to Paul Pelosi, a horrific attack on him in Nancy Pelosi's home. We'll remember as far back as even the Murrah building bombing in 1995. We will remember, and these are domestic attacks. And then, to add to it, just the rhetoric of the president is very violent, and it opens the door for the jostling and throwing around of Senator Padilla, not to mention the threats against Governor Newsom and Mayor Bass, not to mention the unlawful arrest of Mayor Baraka, the Trump, what I believe are trumped up charges against Congresswoman McIver. And it just sort of creates this ugly environment. When he says, in the old days, we used to, you know, beat them and all this kind of stuff, I'll pay for anybody's lawyer who attacks somebody. This is unprecedented for any president. In the past, presidents used to try to calm people. On both sides of the aisle, they never would inflame the bad impulses of people. Not this president. He's all for it. And he's been the target of some of this political violence. And he also has fed the political violence. And we see it, you know.
Of course, you mentioned Paul Pelosi being hit over the head with a hammer. And Donald right. Trump Jr. was mocking him at the time, mocking right. him for that attack. You now have the Democratic Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota confronting her colleague, Republican Senator Mike Lee, over his post on social media about the right. Minnesota shootings, in which he wrote, quote, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way," next to a picture of the alleged gunman shooter. If you can respond to this and then just very quickly tell us about the state and federal charges that have been brought against Vance Belter.
Well, Senator Lee owes America an apology. I hope that he has the courage to admit that he was very wrong. Tina Smith was absolutely right to confront him, and I'm proud of her for that. And let me just say the charges, both state and federal, are appropriate. He violated state laws. He violated federal laws. The state laws are murder. And the grand jury will be reviewing first-degree murder charges against this individual and the federal charges, because the crime employed the use of interstate wire and internet and other things. It's appropriate federal charges as well, and he's going to be charged in both. Which ones will go first? Which trial will proceed first? I don't know. That's probably in a negotiation between state and federal authorities. Both are very well represented. That's actually not going to be my case unless something changes. The state will be represented by Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which is very able to do a good job in this matter. And so investigators are gathering evidence. We urge people, if you know something about this case, please come forward and share it. We must stop political violence. We can argue about our political differences, but in this country, we're supposed to settle political differences at the ballot box, in a courtroom, or in peaceful protests, but never with murderous violence like this. It's completely unacceptable. And I would ask the president to stop his violent rhetoric and call Americans to the better place without changing any of his political views. We just need him to call us to a more peaceful disposition of our conflicts, which are legitimate differences of point of view.
Keith Ellison, want to thank you for being with us, Minnesota Attorney General. Up next, Cuba's deputy foreign minister joins us to talk about the travel ban, the reported U.S. plans to send thousands more immigrants to Guantanamo, and the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Back in 20 seconds.
Una canción de amor esta noche. Es lo que yo te quiero entregar para que solo tú la retoces para romperla luego de amar.
Musician Silvio Rodriguez performing at Central Park here in New York, its summer stage in 2017. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at the Trump administration's tightening restrictions on Cuba, with the island nation among a dozen countries on Trump's travel ban that went into effect last week. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a former Florida Republican senator whose parents were born in Cuba, has spearheaded Trump's attacks on Cuba as a leading supporter of the decades-old economic embargo against the island nation. On his first day in office, Trump reinstated Cuba's designation as a so-called state sponsor of terrorism after President Biden removed Cuba from the list when his term ended. Meanwhile, Rubio has now shifted his focus to target Cuba's medical program that primarily sends Cuban doctors and healthcare workers to assist other countries, including disaster sites and during disease outbreaks. Rubio's accused the Cuban government of forced labor and earlier this month announced several Central American government officials who the U.S. says are linked to Cuba's medical assistance program will face visa restrictions. This all comes as the Trump administration is reportedly planning to transfer thousands of immigrants to Guantanamo to be detained there. Just last week, Trump's Homeland Security Department ordered over 500,000 immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua and Venezuela to self-deport or face arrest after stripping them of their humanitarian parole status, which authorized them to temporarily live and work in the U.S. For more, we're joined here in New York studio by Carlos Fernandez de Cosío. He is Cuba's deputy foreign minister. He just addressed the U.N. General Assembly yesterday, where he again demanded the U.S. lift the catastrophic embargo on Cuba. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We last spoke to you before Trump's second term. If you can start off by talking about your demands at the U.N. yesterday.
Well, thank you for having me. Yesterday, the U.N. had a special session for an item in the agenda of the General Assembly, which is the rejection of unilateral coercive measures. So we were invited to speak, and our main The main message that we took is that the measures that the U.S. take against Cuba go beyond a simple coercive measures or a simple commercial embargo. It's the aim of isolating Cuba or blocking Cuba from the international community and from international economic and trade activity, which has been the aim for a long time to try to choke the Cuban economy. And that was the main message yesterday, where, by the way, a resolution was adopted by the General Assembly designating December 4th of every year UN Day against the use of unilateral coercive measures.
Deputy Foreign Minister, can you talk about the annual vote that occurs at the General Assembly on this issue, where usually it's just the United States and Israel as practically the only nations in the world that continue to support the U.S. embargo?
You're correct. Since 1992, there have been resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly demanding the lifting of the U.S. economic blockade against Cuba. And as you say, only the United States, Israel, and every now and then some other state reject this resolution. It's a long call by the UN, which the United States simply disrespects.
And now that the Trump administration has elevated a Cuban-American from Florida, Marco Rubio, as Secretary of State, what has that meant in terms of U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America?
It means that there's a presence and an influence of anti-Cuban politicians in the U.S., which is there's an increase in their influence greater than any previous moment, and allows them to push this narrow approach, which is not relevant to the interest of most Americans, and this narrow approach against Cuba and against other countries in the region.
I want to play for you Secretary of State Marco Rubio taking questions during a joint news conference in March with the Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness in Jamaica.
It's not that they're Cuban doctors. It's that the regime does not pay these doctors, takes away their passports, and basically it is, in many ways, forced labor. And that we cannot be in support of, again, not speaking about here in particular, but in general about the program.
If you can respond to Marco Rubio's allegations.
He has been, for several years, since he was a senator, attacking Cuba's medical programs around the world that most people know have been able to deploy more doctors in third world countries than the World Health Organization. He has tried to discredit it, beginning by saying that they were spies, that they were political officials, not doctors. He has changed course. Now he's saying that they're slaves. And he alleges a set of ideas which are absurd, because what the program is very similar to any program taken by U.S. organizations, European organizations, or even U.N. agencies when they carry out support in terms of how they hire the doctors, how they are paid, how they are provided for, and how they perform their tasks.
I want to ask you about the group of migrants that were supposedly en route while they were being deported from the United States to South Sudan. Two of them were from Cuba. We have reports of them being kept in a truck container along with the ICE guards that are guarding them. They were stopped by a judge, so they're in Djibouti. But if you can talk about the deportations and if Cuba is accepting deportation flights now that the U.S. has stripped those who are here on humanitarian grounds from being here.
We have with the U.S. bilateral migration agreements that go back to the 1980s. And within them, it includes regular deportation flights for people that the United States considers are inadmissible in the United States. And that continues to go on today. But the real picture here is the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that have come to the U.S. invited by the government. It is known that there has been for decades a policy of privileged flexibility for Cubans. So now you take this great mass of Cubans, which have been invited. They didn't have to tear down a wall to enter the United States. And now the government changes their mind and tells them, no, now you have to return. These are not furniture. This is not cattle. These are real human beings. And migrating is a dramatic decision, that have taken the decision to come here, have a family here, have a job here, and now the U.S. tells them that they have to go back. We find it very cruel. We've expressed it to the U.S. government. We've said it publicly, And we think it's and we find that the politicians, some of them very hostile to Cuba, that have invited these people are now silent and are complicit with their expulsion to Cuba or to another country.
And Deputy Foreign Minister, I wanted to ask you about some reports over the last year or two in right-wing media outlets in the United States, but also some in more establishment media like the BBC and El País from Spain, that there have been hundreds of Cubans fighting as soldiers for Russia in Ukraine. And some are alleging that the Cuban government is backing this. I'm wondering if you could clarify the position of Cuba on this issue.
This became public in, I think it was in August of 2023, and it was Cuba that made it public when we found that there was a network coming out of Russia and coming out of Ukraine and other countries trying to recruit soldiers for that war for both sides. And we were very firm on it. We made it public. We spoke with the Russian embassy. We spoke with the Ukrainian embassy. And we said that this is unacceptable. And we've been very clear that by going to any other country and to try to fight as a soldier from Cuba, you are breaking the law in Cuba. So Cuba has a strong position. We know that there have been found people both on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side, which are Cubans or of Cuban origin. But it's not... absolutely not something that Cuba is encouraging or where the Cuban government is participating.
Deputy Foreign Minister, can you respond to what's happening now between Israel and Iran? I know that the foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, has publicly condemned Israel's actions in Gaza. If you can talk about Gaza as well.
Our president and our foreign minister and our government in general has put a very strong condemnation of Israel's unilateral attack against Iran and for the targeted assassinations that it has carried out. We have been very clear that we reject that. We see it as part of Israel's aggressive role in the region, and it's a follow-up of the genocide that is committing against the people of Palestine.
And I'm wondering also if you could comment on the continued use of the U.S. government of Guantanamo as its sort of its own this place outside U.S. law where it can do whatever it wants and ship people in as prisoners onto the Guantanamo base.
The Guantanamo base is a U.S. military enclave in territory that it has taken from Cuba. It is Cuban territory, as recognized by the U.S., but the presence there is against the will of the Cuban people, and we demand for that base to be removed from it. Now, its use for housing criminals, as is done for many years, its use for taking migrants and putting them there, we also reject it because of the inhuman treatment that they receive, but also because a great amount of individuals housed there by the U.S. government or imprisoned there, it's a danger to peace. That is a highly militarized zone. It's a danger for peace and tranquility in Cuba and for the countries of the region.
Could Cubans be deported from the United States to Guantanamo?
Well, not from the U.S. government. It seems that they think that they can do anything. I don't know if they have deported any Cuban to the base in Guantanamo. We know that they are deporting Cubans to Cuba on regular flights, but we don't know of any Cuba that has reached there.
We just have 20 seconds. We started with the embargo. Let's end the sanctions. What's the actual effect on people of Cuba?
It's a huge effect. It influences daily life, the standard of living, the tranquility, the peace of people. And it is the aim of these coercive measures, to make life as difficult as possible for the Cuban people so that they can have political goals.
Carlos Fernandez de Cossío, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Cuba's deputy foreign minister. We'll be doing an interview in Spanish and posting it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.
Hi, I'm Kaylin.
And I'm Rebecca.
We're the hosts of Sociologic, broadcasting live at CJSF 90.1 FM from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday.
Tune in to hear meaningful conversations exploring all ideas through a sociological lens.
CJSF